great range, you no longer hear, excuse me, individual static crashes. That's what I think is going on here. K2KEY, K2LIW.
We're looking at a, what they used to call in the old days, St. Elmo's fire. Is that, are we looking at another form of it, over?
Possible, but I don't think so, Mel. Each individual thundercloud, and there's a lot of them in one particular thunderstorm, and you've got hundreds of thunderstorms within the beam width of your antenna when you talk about 10,000-mile type range. There's a scattering of thunderstorms going around this Earth all the time. Mother Nature's continuously doing that. You could say she's continuously charging the ionosphere with the 300 kilovolts, and that's part of what John and Wesley would like to tap into, and it's not going to be easy. One hell of a challenge, but you could say Mother Nature is continuously charging the ionosphere by thousands of thunderstorms going on at every instant of time. And so you're looking at a lot of high voltage discharges of all kinds. Corona discharge, individual lightning bolts, positive, negative, cloud-to-cloud lightning, cloud-to-ground lightning, ground-to-cloud lightning, all kinds of things going on. Yeah, a little bit of that some Elmo's power. Let's call it all high voltage in-air discharge phenomena. You've got enough of those going on at each millisecond of time in your particular beam width of your antenna, your 50-degree beam width and 10,000-mile range. You're looking at such a huge area of Mother Earth simultaneously. If the ionosphere is supporting it, you're looking at a lot of high voltage phenomena going on all at once, and that becomes an extremely broadband hiss. You could call it the central limit theorem of statistics, if you know what I mean, the Gaussian curve. And whenever individual crashes are combined, and there's zillions of them per millisecond, it is a broadband hiss. That's what I think is happening, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, when you observe on the top of the tower, this discharge, how did you see it on a ship that was at a wooden ship, with a wooden mast, with sails, you know, nothing really but anywhere near as productive as your tower. What the heck was that up there that they called it St. Elmo's fire? What really were they called? Is that actually some kind of static discharge, I think, over?
There are lots and lots of stories of seamen on wooden ships throughout all of history seeing all kinds of phenomena during thunderstorms, lightning storms, and whatever. That wooden ship you think is an insulator. It's not. The word insulator is a very relative word. A modern-day ship with steel masts is a real conducting object connected to seawater, and the majority of the discharges they get are at the top of that mast. But in the case of a wooden ship, you've got a certain amount of sap, you've got a certain amount of water absorbed into that wooden mast from the last rainstorm of a week ago, and so that mast is always partially conductive. So lots and lots of seamen have seen all kinds of high voltage phenomena going on the rigging, on the stays, on the mast, on the sails, coming down to the deck. It's a partially conducting medium. It's a high altitude object. I mean, the mast of that ship in many cases is 100 feet in the air, and it's a partially conducting object, and that ship is not a pure insulator. To make that ship a pure insulator, it would have to be made out of something like plexiglass, and you'd have to keep it completely dry on the surface. You can't do that. That ship is a partial conductor, and it's attracting lightning, if you know what I mean. It's the highest object within the nearest 50 miles of that thunderstorm over that particular sea, and you're going to get all kinds of high-voltage phenomena. So can you more easily get St. Elmo's fire on a partially conducting probe going into that atmosphere? Very easily, as I see it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Don't forget the salt, Dick.
There you go. And there's not only, you got salt spray on top of that wood, giving it moisture and salt. That's a very, lightning-wise, that's a very conductive medium as far as initiating lightning. And I'll bet you lightning striking that mast happened rather frequently. Over to you, Mel.
I guess so, you know, but you never heard of any documented reports that they saw that so-called so-called St. Elmo fire that nobody ever reported somebody being injured, you would think, with all that post-lightning. You never heard of anybody really being injured by that that effect. Yet you've heard many times people getting literally killed standing under a tree or out in, you know, riding the kid over here a couple of years ago, got killed here, and I just passed by the front. It felt Parkway. So, yeah, seldom heard of any of these seamen saying, oh boy, it was deadly, over.
Okay, KC2QIQ with a comment.
I'm going to pick up with Glenn in a minute. Let me drop. All of the high voltage phenomena that occurred at sea, Mel, guarantee an awful lot of it sounded like a fairy tale. Properly described by a person with only partial vocabulary to try to understand what he is seeing makes it sound like a fairy tale. And I guarantee a lot of those sailors were very reluctant to describe it for fear that they would be ridiculed. My whole family, on one particular occasion, saw a definite UFO from my backyard. And when I describe it to my ham radio friends, a certain percentage of them will say, yes, I've seen something similar. A significant percentage of them will say, oh, boy, you're crazy. There's so many explanations for what that was. You couldn't possibly be seeing what you thought you saw. This heavy pushback, if you haven't personally experienced it, it's very easy to say, you're crazy, it didn't really happen. So I suspect that the description of the St. Elmo's fire-like phenomena on a wooden ship in, let's say, 1890, such that it would be very difficult for a seaman to describe it and be accepted. He would be ridiculed, therefore, his strongest tendency to keep his mouth shut. Very similar to many pilots and many astronauts have seen all kinds of crazy things that they are afraid to describe for a whole bunch of reasons. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Mel, just to mention that, you know, when I was living in Florida, the idea of people getting struck by lightning, especially along that Route 4 area and seeing items being struck by lightning, was almost commonplace. People would die by the numbers of like 11 people per year in Florida during the summertime. Very, very nasty stuff. And people who have survived it or had it happen nearby have described the smelling of very, very strong ozone just before the blast and seeing like a glowing of, or like some kind of plasma buildup before, you know, the large bang happens of a lightning discharge. I've experienced myself at Jones Beach during the summertime while a large storm came in, and just watching items as the storm came in and seeing, especially more towards the evening when the sky got very, very dark, items just begin to glow, but just moments before the lightning hits. And something tells me that that's a very, very dangerous situation, Mel, and something you don't want to witness. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let's have a couple more words on this one, Glenn. You are at the Jones Beach at nighttime. It's starting to get dark. A thunderstorm is coming along. What objects did you see starting to glow? Edges of buildings, edges of safety rails on a boardwalk. What did you see? And you probably have seen this phenomenon on a number of occasions. Go slow and tell us what you saw, because I think this could be fun stuff. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I've heard it described by other people first, Dick, but I'll give you my eyewitness account. The couple of times, actually I've seen it more than once, but both times in the same place and on different days. And I was parked in Field 4, looking out over the ocean at Jones Beach. And because at Field 4, you have a really nice view where you can pull your car pretty much right up to the beach end right there and then look out over the beach and have almost a clear view right to the ocean's edge. And where I've seen it happen was not near any of the buildings or near the sandy area or the parking lot, but seeing it happen in the distance, almost right at where, let's say, like the sand meets the ocean. And, you know, and if I remember correctly, it wasn't so much that it was nighttime. It was that the storm clouds were coming in and actually blocking out the sun. And it got pretty dark as the storm clouds came in. And just as the clouds were coming over, I could see, like, a glowing effect. And, you know, at first I thought it might be, you know, something, you know, like the sun reflecting against the ground. But it really wasn't. It was actually, you know, it would start off like a, like almost like a bluish green color, and then it got lighter and lighter, and then all of a sudden, as it went from like yellow, you know, it could stay at blue and, you know, blue to green for like a period of time. And it would, you know, you could count it in like 10 seconds, it would stay there. But once it started shifting color to the lighter colors, like getting close, once you saw yellow, you knew the blast was going to happen soon. And, you know, big bang. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Now, what were you actually seeing glowing from bluish toward green, toward yellow, and so on? Is it the sand? In other words, you're looking through quite a bit of atmosphere, probably 300, 500 feet, 1,000 feet of atmosphere, parallel to the ground, looking over the sand at a grazing angle toward the water. Was it blades of grass? Was it the sand itself? Was it the boardwalk, the safety rail? What was it that, or was the whole horizon glowing, so to speak? What was the actual lit up object, if you could describe that, Glenn? Go ahead.
I would say it was very, very low down towards the ground level at the beach right near the seashore. So it was almost like where the water was meeting the beach. Optically, it looked like where the water was meeting the beach. It could have been happening somewhere in the sand, but from my point of view, when it was where I was sitting inside the car, was not about to get out and start looking a lot closer or from different angles. But I had a very good point, because there's a break in the boardwalk there. There's like basically like a concrete area, and you can look just beyond the parking lot directly out over the ocean right there at Field 4. And there's no dunes or anything else in the way. So I had a very, very good view of the seashore, right where the sand met the beach. And optically, that's what it looked like, right there. And it wasn't the sand glowing or anything. It was actually like the best way to describe it is almost like a plasma a haze right at sea level. And it was just above the sand where the sand met the seashore, right there at ground level. And just looking straight at it and watching that color haze right there just... And as I've heard it described by other people who've seen it before as what they call ball lightning. Not necessarily that's a correct name for it, but that's what some people do refer to it as. And it happens right at ground level. And I've heard some people have said they've seen it also on golf courses, where it happens right in open fields, right at very, very near ground level. And it's and usually you can smell ozone in the air when it happens. I didn't smell the ozone because I think it was just far enough away, Dick, but it was interesting that right where that took place, there was a very, very large, almost blinding flash, but it wasn't like the streaks you'd normally see up in the sky, and it was very, very loud when it finally arced over.
Now I'm going to ask you, Glenn, to try to give me a angular extent of what you saw. In other words, you're looking out the windshield of your car, you're looking toward the water, this glow that you see. Make a rough guess as to how many degrees horizontal and how many degrees vertical was the view you're looking at glowing. And in order to help you out, a fist held out in front of your body, arm length stretched all the way, the top of your fist to the bottom of your fist is 10 degrees. Each individual finger at arm's length has a width of roughly 2 degrees. So with that as a rough guess, how many degrees of horizontal view had this glow? How many degrees vertical was this glow when viewed out the windshield of your car? KC2 QIQ, K2RIW on the deck net.
Well, I would say that at the beach, sea level, of course the parking lot is above sea level, otherwise it would be flooded, but it's not tremendously higher. So I would say that probably the parking lot is maybe 10 to 20 feet above sea level, and the beach gradually runs off about 200 to 250 feet to where the ocean sea floor is, you know, right there where the seashore, the sand meets the ocean right at that one spot. And so, you know, over, let's say, like 250 feet, maybe a 20-foot drop, and, you know, right there at the seashore. So it was almost like right where the water meets the sand at ground level. So I would say probably no more than a 5-degree pitch, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, a 5-degree pitch vertical. How many degrees horizontal was glowing?
I would say it was pretty narrow. let's say that the area, like if I were just looking at the whole seashore in front of me, it would be, if I was holding my fist horizontal, the four knuckles, you know, looking straight out, it was a patch no wider than that. So it was kind of like a little narrow patch. Maybe if I was holding it up optically, my fist straight out in front of me, about that width of one fist width wide, you know, at the seashore, you know, saying, you know, 250 to 300 feet out.
Okay, very good, Glenn. We've now made it quantitative as to what you saw. In other words, we know the approximate, within a 2-to-1 error ratio, we know approximately how many degrees horizontal and how many degrees vertical was this glowing. Would you say the air was doing the glowing, or would you say the sand was doing the glowing? What was your sense on that one, Glenn? Go ahead.
From my optical point of view, I would say it was the air. It was definitely the air itself, because there's really no objects there at the seashore. There was, you know, because all the objects are, you know, close to the parking lot, the buildings. So this was like the air right near where the, you know, where the beach met the water, right at that edge.
And when the lightning bolt did come along, which was very loud, did the lightning bolt hit somewhere near that area? Is question number one. And number two, during this particular storm, when you observed this, did the event repeat, or did that whole event happen only once? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, in that spot, it only happened once on that particular day. I've seen it similar in a similar location, but not exactly the same location. It happened at a different time. And the way I would describe it is, looking out, I saw what would appear to be some kind of like a blue to green type of plasma that stayed there for a while. You could actually watch it almost like form. And it drifts a little bit. You know, it does move around a little bit, but not by a large amount. And then all of a sudden, it just starts changing to lighter and lighter colors, like from blue to a green, from a green to something that looks like a yellow. But once it starts getting to the lighter colors, it almost immediately goes to like white, and it's blinding, like you know, much stronger than a you know, the flash from a camera. You're going to be blinking your eyes because it is that bright. And within about half a second later, you hear the noise. That flash, it's almost blinding. And you can't really make out any kind of a streak or anything. It's just like a bright, intense light that happens instantaneously, and it almost blinds your vision.
Wesley recognized. Did the lightning bolt appear to strike near the center of the plasma cloud you were seeing, Glenn? Go ahead.
It's hard to describe it as a bolt. It was just almost like this little plasma cloud was sitting there, minding its own, changing color, and it got the lighter color. All of a sudden, it got extremely bright, and then, of course, the sound was like a half a second behind it. But it was right in that spot. But I'm just saying that the white light is so, you know, which the blue is a mellow little light, you know, haze in the background. And even as it starts getting to yellow, still a light haze. But the minute that flash takes place, your eye can't detect any shape or anything to it. It's just a huge flash. And there's no, like, streak or anything because it's so blinding. You know, as I said, you really have to blink your eyes. And and it's just over in a flash. It's just, poof, it's gone. But it's right in that spot where you see it happen. So it's almost like you're watching the lightning form at right at ground level, right there, and then just pow, it's just a huge, you know, white ball of light. And it's, as I said, it's blinding. You really have to close your eyes, and it's almost like looking into a flash cube when somebody takes your picture.
And if that occurred 500 feet from you at the speed of sound, it would take half a second to get to you, and that's approximately the time delay you saw. So I can tell that was very local. Guarantee you were extremely happy about being inside of a metal cage called automobile at that time. If you were on that beach in that area, guarantee you'd be at risk. And there are a significant number of people that are struck with lightning per year. Wesley, N2XJN, go right ahead, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, N2XJN, I have a question, but with the new regulation. I just don't know when should I ask for that question.
We've covered enough lightning for tonight. We can always go back to it. Go right ahead with your question, Wesley. And you're allowed to ask a question on any subject you like, except high voltage in the ionosphere. I'm having fun with you. Over to you, Wesley.
Make a quick request first.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
Because Wesley's and John's project's been going on for so long, I really don't have any sense of, you know, when they ask a question, what the question applies to. So maybe, Wesley, you can give us a quick synopsis of where you're at and how the question applies to that.
Yeah, I'm trying to process what exactly this question of yours is about, and so I would appreciate if you have just a little explanation to that.
I'm going to jump in on this one now. As I see it, Alan, John and Wesley are involved into, the best I can explain, in the New York City area among ham radio enthusiasts as a kind of pure research. And that is to say, they're trying to get a greater understanding of magnetics, electrostatics, high voltage, rotary machinery, Tesla coils. They're gathering a lot of test equipment. They're gathering, they only have, like the rest of us, they only have partial understanding of the vocabulary. They're in a learning curve. They're seeking, I mean, ham radio, you could say, what does a ham seek? It is a unclearly defined goal, what hams are seeking. I mean, you got 26 different kinds of ham radio. Are they seeking an understanding of antennas, an understanding of transmitters, receivers, transmission lines, propagation? Or we can list 50 things. What are hams seeking? All of the above. And to a small degree, I think John and Wesley are doing somewhat that. I don't think it is an extremely focused investigation yet. I think it's going to become more focused as time goes on. But my best guess is it is somewhat unfocused, pure research. I wonder if that answer is partially satisfying, Alan. KC2RFN, K2RIW.
No, I know that because I listen in on the conversations quite a bit. It's just that I know they're working towards something, and it's obtaining energy, and it's very interesting. But when you start getting into the greater details of equipment and such, I'm wondering, you know, what the equipment is for. What is it they're trying to work on that they're running into trouble and are now reaching out for help? That's what I mean. Like, I know you had a couple of tech nets that dedicated to some of the equipment they're using, and I was saying, gee, you know, that's interesting. I may or may never use that kind of equipment, but what are they using it for? You know, is it to build coils, or is it to build a certain kind of a circuit? You know, I'm just looking for the root reason for the basic question, because that'll make answering it more interesting to the listener.
Yes, some of what's going on is not going out over the air, Alan. Some of the communications that are being done by email between John, me, all of a sudden my mind's gone blank on people's names, Andy and others, and Glenn, and I mean, yes, Andy, Glenn, Eric, some of the research going on with some of the equipment these guys are gathering is not being publicly announced. It's a kind of behind-the-scenes research. That's some of it. But the whole ham radio process itself is a group of enthusiastic people with a scientific bent, fervently seeking a goal that is not clearly defined. We amateurs are enthralled with the wireless process, which includes a whole lot of individual kinds of components, and we'd like to understand all of them. I mean, there are times when you personally were focused on antenna A, then antenna B, then transmission line C, and so on. We all are hopping from subject to subject. Theirs is a little bit more broadband, a little bit less defined, a little bit more fervent, obvious by the amount of money they're putting into it. So I don't think they've got a clearly defined goal, but we're all learning something in the process. And as long as we do it late enough at night that it doesn't disturb people, I see a lot of potential benefit. Pure research of any kind, in many cases, at the time the person launches into pure research, he's trying to find out what Mother Nature is telling him, and he may have no application in the world. I'll bet you more than half of all of the beneficial research that has ever been done, somebody later found out an application for the discovery, and that at the time of the discovery, it wasn't dedicated toward any particular goal other than just understanding physics in general. That's a set of opinions on my part. Wesley, go right ahead with your question. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think he did it, Tom. Okay, N2XJN. Well, I can add a little bit to that. Some people can learn how to put the nail into the wall. For that, they need a hammer. Some others enjoy fishing. And they are very much involved into all of this stuff that is needed for fishing. And some of us, that means me and John, wants to always learn in the certain areas of science and knowledge. By that token, I could say that you can find the electrician who is good electrician. But the electrician who is very much involved into electronics are just fewer of them. But then you take the electrician who is very much involved in electronics and has a certain knowledge with it, but then he's very much involved in mechanics. Well, then you have even less people. So, if the question is, what is it for? Well, the primary goal was education. By acquiring the equipment, I had to learn about all of the equipment available on the market and find all of the features. And when I had something that is called Wayne Kare magnetic analyzer, precision magnetic analyzer, then I had 20 different similar devices, and I had to educate myself to the point that I know that this is exactly what I need. And most of this equipment is very expensive equipment, so then there was a hunt for something that is relatively affordable to us. So it started about March of this year from me digging for the free energy device. But at the beginning of the year, I remember I was preparing myself for the TechNet, and I was digging about energy devices, and all of a sudden I found free energy. So I was laughing. For 20 years, I was standing at the level of traditional science. During my scientific activity, and professional scientific activity, I was standing at the same basis, and all of a sudden I flipped. So there are three major routes of free energy, if we can say that ever exist. One of them is HHO, which is the energy from water by converting it to the gases. The other one is neodymium magnet motors, which is rotary devices. And the third one is Tesla concept that was in various forms tried to be applied. And I decided I'm going to go to the third one. But then all of a sudden I find out that it would be good to have a mechanical part of my lab that will allow me also to experiment with two other forms of free energy that ever exist. By that terms, I'm acquiring the knowledge, and I'm asking everybody, including Dick, to enlighten me in these areas, and of course including you, sir. So, my question is... let's say we have a 4,000 volts, and then we have whatever current we can make from the anode of the power amplifier tube. And I'm referring to the HARP program. Now, we don't have a 30,000 volts, we have a 5,000 volts, let's say a 4,000 volts. Now, the power is the factor of volts times current. Now, I was asking about the mechanical particles being activated, creating an aurora, and maybe the heat that is involved with it by the presence of high power radio waves. I just don't understand this mathematics. When anything is happening in the ionosphere, it's happening on the pad from the Earth, from the HARP transmitter and the antenna system to the ionosphere. It is not that it is happening only in ionosphere. And if it is, then we're talking about some kind of resonance that is actually activating the particles. Now, I simply cannot understand the last statement of Dick, who stated that, well, the breakdown of the air is 30,000 volts per cubic centimeters. Guess what? We didn't, never had 30,000 volts. It doesn't matter what voltage do we have, we can still get the power. 12 volts times 10,000 amps. That could theoretically stir the very powerful set of transistors. So, we never had that voltage. I'm trying to understand the mathematics behind that. We have the electromagnetic wave that is extremely strong. How that reacts with the particles, mechanically. Dick, pick up.
I may not completely understand your question, Wesley, but I'm going to give you information that might help. When it comes to the voltage you're applying to the tube of the final stage of a transmitter, there you've got a very measurable amount of volts, like 4 kilovolts coming out of your power supply, a very measurable number of amperes, that tube doing its work, acting as a valve where it's cutting off and allowing electrons to flow through. It's got cyclic current flow. It is charging energy into that pi network that's usually there, and your pi network is an impedance match between the tube. The tube may represent a 2,000 ohm impedance, and your transmission line you want to feed is a 50 ohm impedance, and the pi network is giving you that impedance transfer. So generating power and delivering that power to an antenna, and maybe the antenna has got a 50 ohm or a 70 ohm impedance. So to get the power transfer from your power supply through the tube, through the pi network, through the transmission line, through the antenna, and radiated into space, we amateurs pretty much understand that part of the phenomenon. What happens after that, most amateurs, and I'm maybe one of them, don't have a great deal of understanding. But let me tell you what I do know. Let me drop. Air at standard temperature and pressure, at sea level, has a dielectric strength of 30,000 volts per centimeter. If at sea level, it doesn't matter if the air is dry or moist, the dielectric strength of the air is very close to the same. It's a hard one to believe. Very close to 30,000 volts per centimeter. If I did an experiment where I put my air at not one atmosphere, but two atmospheres inside of a bell jar, we'll say, I'll find out that the air has a dielectric strength of 60,000 volts per centimeter. You increase the air pressure, and the air is a better high-voltage standoff insulator. And I can explain that one. Go in the other direction. You go to lower and lower pressures, and you can break down the air not at 30,000. You can break it down at 15, 10, 5, 3. You could probably break down air at 600 volts if you've got a... It's got just the right amount of vacuum of just the right air, just the right gas. Probably 600 volts per centimeter will give you a breakdown. That's one phenomenon. And that's, as I said, that's quite explainable if you want to go into those details. Why a lower pressure of air, it's called the mean free pass phenomenon, why you get an electronic discharge through that gaseous material. Let me drop. Now, in my opinion, HOMP is not breaking down the air in the ionosphere. In my opinion, HOMP is not using a frequency where the particles in the ionosphere are resonant. They don't have to be resonant. That microwave oven will deliver RF energy into the water that's in your food without going through any kind of resonance of the water. That microwave oven happens to be at 2450 megacycles. You could have, in theory, designed it at 500 megs, 5 gigahertz, 15 gigahertz. The frequency that you use, for the most part, does not matter because you're not using resonance. You're using another phenomenon. Now, the ionosphere itself is up at a very high altitude where the air pressure is extremely low. As such, the mean free path, in other words, those air molecules up in the ionosphere are moving at something like 500 meters per second, as are the air molecules that are in the room with you. But in the case of the air molecules at the ionosphere, they are so far apart from each other that they travel a very long distance before one hits another. Very important phenomenon. That combined with the continuous ultraviolet light coming out of the sun, hitting that atmosphere, is ionizing those particles. In other words, the electrons are being yanked away from those protons, the nucleus, and you've got a plasma. The ionosphere is a plasma. Let me drop. A plasma really means you have a partially conducting gaseous, usually gaseous, medium. Because once those electrons and protons get separated from each other by ultraviolet exposure, among other things, it takes them a long time to recombine. Because the mean free path is so large, the separation between those individual air molecules is so great that it takes them a long time for a proton to find another free electron and recombine and stop becoming a plasma. So once you establish a plasma at the ionospheric altitude, it tends to stay there for a while, particularly during the sunny part of the day. But even when sun goes away, because it's on the backside of the Earth, so to speak, that plasma stays there for a significant period of time, obvious by the fact that you and I can do a lot of 20-meter propagation in the nighttime. That tells me that plasma didn't get a chance to recombine. Once you've got that conducting plasma, you don't have to be anywhere near a resonant frequency. You deliver a significant amount of RF energy in watts per square meter to that ionosphere. You will change its ionospheric, its ionizing characteristics. And then for the most part, I think you're doing more ionizing, but it doesn't require resonance to do it. Just the fact that the medium is a plasma, which means it is partially conductive, it is like a sheet of rubber that's conductive. If I deliver RF energy to a sheet of rubber, it will absorb it. If I deliver RF energy to my anechoic material, which is a bunch of foam, it's got a whole bunch of carbon molecules, carbon particles inside of it, it is a absorptive medium, and it doesn't care what frequency. So the exact frequency you use to light up the ionosphere with the HOMP experiment doesn't matter. You can choose what frequency there where you have, let me drop. The HOMP experiment has the freedom to choose whatever frequency where they have available transmitting devices that can give them a lot of power without spending a lot of money. They can also choose a wavelength where, with reasonable design of an antenna that only fills up a certain number of acres of property, you get reasonable antenna gain or directivity, the beamwidth. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, you can get less and less beamwidth out of the same amount of area. But as you go to higher and higher frequencies, it becomes more expensive to develop a whole lot of power. So the 400 megacycle region, which is one of the regions that was used for HOMP, is a convenient compromise. High enough frequency where they get enough directivity out of the antenna and can do electronic steering of the antenna. Low enough in frequency where you don't have to spend $1 zillion to make high power transmitting devices. So it doesn't require resonance. All it requires is the fact that the ionosphere is there. It's a conducting medium. The conducting medium doesn't go non-conducting for a long period of time. because it's a conducting medium, you hit it with enough RF energy in watts per square meter, you are exciting it to a higher level of excitation because it's conducting, and it's absorbing your energy, not because of resonance.
Oh, I have a question.
But simply because it's conducting. Go ahead, Wesley, wait for the beep.
Okay. The nature of the electromagnetic wave is a pure energy, and it does not have a mass. How that process of ionization is happening to the details? Back to you.
When I heat up a medium, when I absorb energy into a medium, when a medium absorbs energy.
The moment you just said you heat up, that means you're heating up with the RF energy, right?
Absolutely. When I've got a conducting medium and I hit it with a RF E field, because it conducts, because I'm giving it an E field, current will flow. Current is flowing through the ionosphere medium, and it is absorbing that energy because it is a resistive medium, and I'm applying a voltage across it, as if it was a resistor, but it happens to be a distributed volumetric resistor. And I'm putting an E field and an H field, but let's call it about the E field, it's the easy one to understand. I'm giving it an E field across a conducting volumetric medium, and whether I made it out of a block of resistive material, like a carbon block, or whether I make it the ionosphere, in either case, I deliver a radio wave to it, energy gets absorbed. When energy gets absorbed, by definition, the temperature will increase. The temperature is something you and I measure with a thermometer, but what does it really mean? Anything that has a higher temperature means that each individual molecule must, by definition, have more kinetic energy. That's what temperature is. Average kinetic energy of the molecules is the average temperature of those molecules. Because the molecules of the ionosphere are being heated, that's a fancy way of saying you're increasing their temperature. If you're increasing their temperature, they are moving faster. When they move faster, they collide with each other more frequently. When they collide with each other more frequently, they have a higher probability of creating a chain reaction that creates more ionization. I believe that could be the mechanism of how a strong radio wave hitting the ionosphere makes the molecules move faster, makes more chain reaction, makes more ionization. That's what I think is happening, but I'm not positive on this one.
Possible then the light that is coming from the sun is partially reflected from the aurora, because it does have to be a different process when we ionize the particles with the radio waves, and the photons from the sun are coming, and they actually have different structure. The whole ability of us being able to see aurora, that's what I'm asking you for. Is there any change to the process of the photons being delivered to the Earth? Back to you.
It's my belief that the sun does a lot of ionizing of the ionosphere by using ultraviolet energy coming out of the sun. The ultraviolet energy, which is very broadband, very high in frequency, very short in wavelength, that I believe does hit some form of resonance with the individual air molecules in the ionosphere, and it does create ionization. The ultraviolet light does give a very nicely coupled energy between sun and ionosphere.
We come up with our HARP transmitter, and then we interfering somehow with that traditional delivery.
I'm going to go two questions back that you already asked. What causes the light of the aurora? The light of the aurora is primarily due to the solar wind. The solar wind are real physical particles being boiled off at the sun. Millions of pounds of stuff is being boiled off from the sun at every instant during a coronal mass expulsion. a great big blast of those materials gets directed directly toward the Earth. Those particles are charged particles. They hit the magnetic field between the North Pole and the South Pole of the Earth. They move parallel to that magnetic field. Therefore, they are going to go along that magnetic field and strike the Earth at the magnetic North Pole and the magnetic South Pole. In the process of those real physical particles moving at a million miles an hour, striking the air molecules in the upper atmosphere, that creates the aurora, the light. It's the physical velocity of those particles of the solar wind striking the upper air molecules. And depending on the strength of those particles and what they really are, you sometimes get a red glow when they hit the oxygen molecules and a blue glow when they hit the nitrogen molecules and so on. So it is a physical impact process is the majority of what the aurora light is, in my opinion. But now, the ultraviolet, let me drop. The ultraviolet output of the sun is the major causative action of the ionizing of the upper air molecules that causes what you and I call the ionosphere. And now Hoff can develop a significant amount of radio energy into that plasma called ionosphere, deliver power to it because it is a conducting medium. That's what plasma is. It's a volumetric conducting medium. You're delivering power to it by simple Ohm's law, voltage, current, resistance, if you know what I mean. A certain amount of voltage divided by a certain amount of ohms is going to give you a certain amount of current, and it's volumetric current, and you're delivering power. When you deliver power to the ionosphere, it becomes hotter. When it becomes hotter, the molecules move faster. When the molecules move faster, they strike each other with greater energy. When they strike each other with greater energy, you get more ionization. If you get more ionization, you and I call it an increase in the ionosphere. So the Hoff project can increase the density of the ionosphere by delivering power to it, and that becomes essentially a kinetic process of moving those molecules faster. I wonder if that helps a little bit. It's a bunch of speculation on my part, but this is my partial understanding at this time. Into XJN, K2LIW.
Yes, isn't that you just admitted that by using HARP system, we are in micro scale altering the weather? We are actually affecting the phenomena of aurora, because all of these dependencies that you just described, by that, we alternating the weather. We alternating what naturally appears to be traveling from sun to the earth. Back to you.
KC2, QAQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. When you say altering the weather, you got to be careful with this one. When I fly my jet plane from New York to California, I'm adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. I'm changing a small amount of global warming, and I'm affecting the weather. When you drive your automobile, you're affecting the weather. If you pour a glass of water into the ocean, you're affecting the weather. And now it's a matter of degree. Yes, the ionosphere has a minor effect on our weather. The major thing the ionosphere does is it becomes a absorber of ultraviolet light. That's the major thing, that's the major benefit it gives you and me. The amount of sunburn you and I would get would be drastically increased if there was no ionosphere, because the ionosphere is extremely good at absorbing ultraviolet light. That's an extremely minor effect on the atmosphere, the weather. The majority of the weather is coming from that huge spectrum, from DC to light, literally, DC to gamma rays, coming out of the sun. And all of that energy striking the Earth creates a whole lot of heat. And that heat is what creates our weather. The ionosphere is an extremely minor perturbation on our weather, only by way of its shielding of ultraviolet. The ionosphere is extremely transparent at everything except radio waves at a grazing angle, and even that, it's only a partial reflector, and it is absorber of ultraviolet. Other than that, I think it's an extremely minor effect on our weather. KC2QIQ, KQRYW on the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, I just wanted to add that, you know, I strongly agree with exactly everything that you've said so far. And just to add to that a little bit, just describing the difference between the ionosphere and the cloud levels that create our, you know, more local weather. The ionosphere is up at 60 miles westerly. It's a very, very high altitude compared to the weather clouds that are much, much lower. Another major difference between the ionosphere and the cloud level type of weather that affects our normal day-to-day weather is that the ionosphere is basically a magnetic storm, solar wind, that's made up of predominantly positively charged ions, which are mostly oxygen. And what makes the oxygen positively charged is the fact that it has 8 electrons and it loses one. So basically, it's basically oxygen atoms at 60 miles above the Earth minus one electron. And it's that basically kicking off that one electron of oxygen that makes the ionosphere more dense. So the more oxygen molecules up there that you basically knock off, basically that one electron from it, and the more densely you can get those oxygen molecules with one electron kicked off, is going to be the more intense solar magnetic field you're going to have. And this solar wind is always moving day and night around the Earth. And let me let it drop for a second. So basically the HARP system is only charging one little corner of the Earth, pointing up at the sky and charging the ionosphere and basically hitting off of these oxygen atoms and trying to ionize them by kicking off one electron by either methods of heat or just the electromagnetic absorption of the radio wave absorbing into that plasma of oxygen, you know, molecules of their atoms. I should really say atoms, not molecules of oxygen. And basically it just keeps on kicking off one electron through both heat and just absorbing the radio waves. And then basically how it's moving is through the natural solar wind, which is always moving around the Earth. So if you can control, if you know which way the wind is blowing, and you keep on reinforcing one part of that ionosphere, you can actually control a path. And it mainly affects electromagnetic waves and has very, very little effect on our lower cloud levels. Let me pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I wondered before Dick pick up, what is the amount of energy per square mile of ionosphere? And with all of these changes, when the aurora shows up, how does it change, and how is being measured? Back to you, Dick.
Lots and lots of good articles you and I can read will say that the weather occurs in the troposphere, and all of our weather that we care about occurs in the first 6 miles from the Earth's surface to 6 miles up. That's the troposphere. That's where all the weather takes place. The ionosphere is roughly 60 miles up, 10 times higher. So you've got this layer of air close to the Earth that we care about weather-wise. 10 times higher, you got this layer of material called ionosphere. The ionosphere doesn't form at lower altitudes because the air molecules or atoms at a lower altitude are much higher in pressure by comparison. Therefore, they're much closer together. Therefore, the mean free path is much smaller. That means when you do have an ionized particle, an oxygen molecule missing one electron, he's much more frequently going to find another free electron that's close to him. He's going to recombine, and he's not ionized anymore. So at lower altitudes, where the atmosphere is more dense, deionization occurs at a very rapid rate. Therefore, although this ultraviolet light is hitting there, it doesn't get a chance to do anything because it gets nullified right away. As you go higher and higher in the atmosphere, the spacing between the molecules or atoms becomes greater and greater. The mean free path, how far they travel before they hit another one, gets greater and greater. The amount of ionization duration time drastically increases. So you may have had a molecule ionized an hour ago, and he is still ionized. He hasn't had a chance to strike another one and regain his missing electron, if you know what I mean. So this is why the ionosphere is so high up, but the ionosphere is formed primarily from ultraviolet exposure. I'm not convinced that the solar wind, which is streaming straight from the sun toward the Earth continuously, there's a certain amount of solar wind coming straight.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A lot of that solar wind is charged particles. And by Lenz's law and Faraday's law, a charged particle moving in a magnetic field gets deflected in a very known way. So those that great big continuous flow of solar wind particles moving at roughly 1 million miles an hour, screaming out of the sun, coming toward the Earth, they start hitting our magnetic field. The magnetic field is a beautiful shield which forces them to move in certain directions, and therefore they move in what you and I would call the Van Allen belt, and eventually by way of the magnetic field that they must flow parallel to will eventually make them strike the atmosphere in the vicinity of the North Magnetic Pole and the South Magnetic Pole. So the ionosphere is a conducting medium, just like my resistor on the table. If I put a certain amount of voltage across that resistor, by Ohm's law I can calculate the current. Once I know the current and the voltage, I know how much wattage I'm dissipating in that resistor. Once I know the wattage of the resistor, I can calculate how fast it's going to get hot. Once I calculate how fast it's going to get hot, I can calculate how fast the molecules of the resistor are going to move faster. Let me drop. And if by AC coupling to that resistor into a low noise amplifier, I can measure the amount of radio noise coming from that resistor because I have heated it, because the heating process made those molecules of the resistor shake more violently in space, in place. They're part of a lattice, they're part of a solid object, they're not completely free to move, but they can shake in place. As I make the resistor hotter, they shake more violently. As they shake more violently, the electrons associated with them are also being shaken more violently, and it makes black body noise. And my low noise receiver can easily measure the noise coming out of that resistor, therefore I can tell you exactly what temperature that resistor is at. If I've impedance matched to it, between the 50 ohm resistor in my example and a 50 ohm input amplifier, I've done that experiment.
Why the electronic of the plane is not showing malfunction or erratic behavior at that altitude?
I heard the words, but I didn't understand the question. Try rewording it, Wesley.
If we need to lower and lower amount of volts in order to change the structure of the conductive media at that altitude, at the same time, all of the resistors, all of the electronic components of the plane, or let's say balloon that was deployed without even the human being on it, the weather balloon, should show malfunction. Back to you.
When you get a lower and lower air pressure, air will break down at a lower and lower voltage until you reach approximately the altitude of roughly 100,000 feet. Then you're starting to get into a hard vacuum and it goes the other way. When you look at the Paschen curve, P-A-S-C-H-E-N, the man who did all that research in the 1800s, it's a bathtub-shaped curve of breakdown voltage versus air pressure. So somewhere around 100,000 volts is the minimum at 100,000 feet of altitude. The ionosphere is at 60 miles altitude, so it is not the Paschen breakdown. You are not breaking down the air by way of a high voltage arc. You are conducting a radio signal into a medium that already, you're propagating a radio signal with HARP into a medium that already is conductive. It is a volumetric resistor.
Yes, and that conductive medium should affect the electronics of balloon, weather balloon that was deployed.
No way in hell. You and and I can fly a weather balloon at 100,000 feet, 20 miles. The ionosphere is at 60 miles. No weather balloon has ever come anywhere near that. So I'm wondering why you're talking about a weather balloon along with the ionosphere.